This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As much as Americans honor our founding fathers, particularly around July 4th, they're often portrayed in ways that don't capture the drama of their lives or the ways in which they shaped our country. My guest Walter Isaacson has written a new biography of Benjamin Franklin that explains why Franklin may be the most accomplished American of his age and the most influential in inventing the type of society America would become. Franklin was the only person to sign all four of America's founding papers, the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty with France, the Peace Accord with Britain, and the Constitution. Walter Isaacson is former managing editor of Time magazine and former chairman of CNN. This year he left CNN to become the president of the Aspen Institute. Your previous book was a biography of Henry Kissinger. Why go from a contemporary figure to one of the founding fathers?
I got very interested in Henry Kissinger's view of realism in American foreign policy and was looking back for the historical roots. And you have to go back to Ben Franklin, who played this absolutely brilliant balance of power game between France, Netherlands, and Spain during the Revolution. And people hadn't really written about that, and that was the first thing that got me interested in Franklin. And to be honest with you, Terry, after writing about a live character like Henry Kissinger, I really wanted to do somebody who'd been dead for 200 years after that.
Why?
Well, there's sort of the agony of taking on somebody, writing a critical biography of somebody who's still alive and having to deal with them afterwards. It was sort of a relief to go back and not have the person calling me up afterwards.
Oh, did Kissinger threaten to sue you or anything?
Oh, I think there were a lot of phone calls and letters.
Right, okay. Well, I should warn you, if you come to Philadelphia, there's somebody dressed like Ben Franklin who walks around the colonial part of the city a lot. So you better be careful.
Yeah, Ralph Archbold. I've run into Ralph Archbold. He's a great Franklin impersonator.
All right. Is there a certain textbook image of Ben Franklin that you'd like to rescue him from?
You got to rescue him from that doddering old sage flying the kite in the rain and spouting maxims like a penny saved is a penny earned or early to bed, early to rise. First of all, he never was an early to bed or early to rise type of guy, and he portrayed himself in that fashion, sort of as a exemplar to young tradesmen. But he was a much more complicated, nuanced man, and not exactly the person he portrayed himself to be in the autobiography.
Why don't we give an example of that? And this is starting with his part of his personal story. And this is the fact that you didn't learn this part in school. He had a child out of wedlock before he was married with a woman who was probably, what, a prostitute?
A woman of low repute is the way it's described in some of the letters. He took responsibility for the son, William, and he raised the son, educated him, and very much in love with the son. And they had a very intense and complicated relationship, William Franklin and his father, Benjamin Franklin. And William Franklin eventually became very aristocratic and stuck as a loyalist during the Revolution as the royal governor of New Jersey. And so they had this huge political falling out in 1775, just as the Revolution was beginning.
Well, he raised this son, William, with the woman that he married, Deborah. Let's talk about his marriage just a little bit. You know, you write that to be a well-respected man in the colonies, you had to be married, and that Franklin knew he had a large sexual appetite, which he had to control also. So he wanted a wife, but he wanted a wife that would bring him a dowry big enough to pay off his debt on his printing press. Why couldn't he achieve that goal?
Well, he almost married somebody who was going to bring him the dowry, but it didn't work out. And printers were not an exalted profession back then. And Franklin realized he was being a little bit too greedy to seek a dowry. And instead, he decided he wanted a practical, frugal, industrious partner as his wife. And that's what Deborah turned out to be. And as he later said, and what passes for deep romantic affection on his part, that meant all the world to me more than any other dowry, somebody who would just be my partner and would be industrious and work side by side with me in the shop.
Now, they had a common law marriage because they couldn't really get married. Would you explain why?
Well, Deborah had been married before. What happened was, she and Ben Franklin got to know each other when they were both very young, when Franklin was a 17-year-old runaway arriving in Philadelphia. But then Franklin goes off and lives in England, and Deborah marries somebody else, a potter. And then the potter disappears. He just runs away. And they were worried about the bigamy laws because they didn't know whether this first husband would ever reappear. So they just entered into a common law union to avoid the bigamy laws.
Mm-hmm. Which would have been punishable by 39 lashes and life imprisonment.
Oh, yes, and also he would have had to assume all the debts of the first husband, which I think worried him more than the 39 lashes.
Let's talk a little bit more about Ben Franklin's family. As we mentioned earlier, his son was illegitimate, born out of marriage, but he and his wife raised the son. And no one seems to know who the mother was. You say, well, it's one of history's delicious mysteries. So they were close when William, the son, was growing up, but then they were on the opposite sides of the Revolution. Franklin supported it, and his son remained a royalist. Can you explain explain that difference?
You know, it was a great human tragedy, one that reflected the tragedy of the politics of the time. Benjamin Franklin loved his illegitimate son, William, raised the kid, educated him, and then William becomes more and more aristocratic, a little bit more pretentious, starts getting a little bit too much on a high horse and putting on airs. And that's why Franklin writes the autobiography. It's a letter to his son, at least initially. It says, remember where you're coming from. You know, we were poor. We're a poor family. We're struggling tradespeople. Don't go putting on airs. But it doesn't work. William Franklin remains loyal to the crown, the royal governor of New Jersey, and in 1775 there's a great showdown between Benjamin Franklin and William Franklin over the Revolution, and they split, and Benjamin Franklin becomes an American patriot and rebel, and William Franklin remains a loyalist to the crown and is finally arrested by George Washington's troops on Benjamin Franklin's orders and finally exiled to England. What makes the soap opera even more wrenching is that William Franklin had his own illegitimate son, a kid named Temple. And Temple was a beautiful little child whom Benjamin Franklin helped raise. Benjamin Franklin provided for the education and helped raise his grandson, Temple. And when they all get together in America in 1775 and 1776, there's a struggle for the heart and the soul of this beautiful kid, Temple Franklin, between Benjamin Franklin, who wants Temple to remain, become an American patriot, and William Franklin, the kid's father, who's trying to keep him loyal to the crown. And Temple Franklin ends up siding with his grandfather and becoming a rebel. And Benjamin Franklin and his grandson Temple sail off to France together without even telling William Franklin that they were going off to France. And it was just this heart-wrenching struggle that's very personal, but it mirrors the great political struggle of the time.
Did Ben Franklin and his son William ever reconcile emotionally or politically?
Right at the end of the Revolution, after Benjamin Franklin negotiates the peace treaty that settles the Revolution and restores peace with England, William Franklin, who's then living in exile in England, writes Benjamin Franklin and says, let's reconcile. And it's a tortured, anguished letter in response from Benjamin Franklin, saying that he would love to get together, that nothing has hurt him more. But then it goes into a screed against William for having opposed him during the Revolution. And it puts off for a while any reconciliation. But finally they meet in Southampton in England while Franklin is about to sail back from Europe to America, the end of the Revolution. And they meet only for one evening, and it's Benjamin Franklin, William Franklin, and the grandson Temple Franklin, all at the Star Inn in Southampton, England. And all they do is negotiate over property, and they both basically take all the American properties and lands from William Franklin and transfer them to the grandson Temple, and then they never speak again and never write again.
So the answer would be, I guess, they never reconciled.
No, it was sad. It was sad.
The reason why I'm particularly interested in hearing all of this is that the Founding Fathers are always held up to us as these, like, paragons of virtue. You know, there's so much of an emphasis in some circles on family values and what that means. And, you know, and so here you have, like, one of the Founding Fathers who has a son out of wedlock. His son, Franklin's son, also has a child out of wedlock. Franklin has to have a common law marriage because his wife's first husband ran off with a slave. I mean, so you know, when you look at like what the country is built on and everything, it's not.
You know, there were
it's not
a lot
these perfect
of
family values.
Well, there were a lot of illegitimate children back amongst the founding fathers in that generation. But, you know, Franklin had a very solid moral life. And I do think there are underlying values that we sometimes trivialize as family values. But the values of loyalty and honesty and industriousness, he believed in that throughout his life. And he took responsibility for everything he did. And in some ways, those are bourgeois, Market Street, middle-class values. But I think in Franklin, you actually see why they're so important to our country.
As the former head of CNN, former managing editor of Time, what did you find most interesting about Ben Franklin's philosophy of being the owner of a printing press, like what it meant to own a printing press?
You know, he was a great media entrepreneur. He not only owns a printing press, but he creates all this great content. He starts a newspaper. He starts Poor Richard's Almanac. And then he franchises it so that all of his friends and former apprentices and relatives across the colonies, he franchises the print shops. And then he creates the U.S. Postal Service so he can have this wonderful distribution system. And he even uses a distribution system to help advantage his content and his own franchises. So in that sense, he was like one of the modern media entrepreneurs of today. And but he believed very much in an open system. He believed in allowing as much competition as possible, as many voices as possible in the media, and he hated the notion of media conglomeration or media domination.
He also believed in publishing many different points of view. He said there'd be very little printed if publishers produced only things that offended nobody.
Oh, that's a wonderful editorial when he first takes over the Pennsylvania Gazette. It's called Apology for Printers. And he was criticized for something he printed, and as you say, and he ends by saying, and if truth and falsity each have fair play, truth will always win out over the falsities. And that's the important thing, you know, that helped this country, was a belief in robust discourse, many different voices of opinion. And Franklin, who, as you said, led this slightly flawed personal life, there were more articles at the time, whenever he ran for election, that would make modern-day stories about Bill Clinton or anything else seem pale by comparison. But Franklin loved it all. He was very honest about his life, and he loved a raucous press, and he didn't mind. He never threatened to sue for libel or anything.
What do you consider the most important thing he ever published?
I think the most important thing, types of writing he did, were those in favor of religious tolerance. And, for example, he did an appeal for a new hall they wanted to build in Philadelphia. And he said, even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send somebody here to preach Muhammad to us, we ought to give him a pulpit. And over again, he wrote things that said we have to be tolerant of all religions. And I think that it's something we forget as being the core value of America. And as we go into the 21st century, where we're facing religious fanaticism around the world, but even religious fundamentalism threatens our liberties at home, I think Franklin's notion of tolerance is the thing I most want people to take from this book.
Ben Franklin went to London to live. He lived there for 11 years, starting in 1765. He went as a representative from the Pennsylvania legislature. Was he a royalist then?
He believed in the British Empire. He called the British Empire a fine, noble china vase, and he said, once it gets shattered, we'll never be able to put it back together. So he fought long and hard for the type of compromises and the type of accommodation that would allow the empire to stay together. And he very much was a believer in the king. He wanted to turn Pennsylvania from being a proprietary colony into a royal colony, but he did not want to overthrow the British Empire or to have an American Revolution until much later.
What's the meaning of a proprietary colony?
It just meant that the Penn family was sort of the owners of the colony. So instead of being governed directly by the king, it was governed by these proprietors who owned it, the Penn family.
So what changed Franklin's mind about being a royalist? What turned him into a supporter of the American Revolution?
It was pretty late, around 1774, 1775. He finally gives up all hope that he can hold things together. He's humiliated by the British ministers and by the king's ministers, the prime minister in London, as he tries to argue that they should not subject the colonies to tyranny and to taxation without representation. And so finally he sails back from London in early 1775, gets back to America, and he declares his break with Britain and becomes a patriot and a rebel.
What do you think was his greatest contribution to organizing for the Revolutionary War?
Well, he was the one who came up first with the concept of federalism, really, which is taking all the different colonies, 13 colonies, and saying that they'd each remain colonies or states, but they'd be part of a larger whole, that you'd have a federal government as well as state governments. And in as early as 1754, in the Albany Plan, it was called, because they went to Albany, New York, to discuss it, he came up with a plan for uniting the colonies. And then even in 1776, as they're writing the Declaration of Independence, he comes up with the first Articles of Confederation, where you share power between the states and the federal government.
He went to France to get aid for the Revolutionary War, financial aid. What made him so good at that task?
He was very seductive. He goes to France, and even though he's a city person, he's lived in Philadelphia and in London his whole life, he knows that the French romanticize the frontier. So he rides into the streets of Paris wearing a fur cap and a leather frock and pretending to be the sage and philosopher from the frontier and from the backwoods and stuff. And he never wears the powdered wigs, and he has all these portraits of himself painted. He really understood the value of celebrity. He also understood the nobility and idealism of the American cause. He had helped Thomas Jefferson write the Declaration of Independence. And he had the Declaration reprinted in France, where he knew it would appeal to the sentiments of the people. In fact, he made a remarkable edit to the Declaration of Independence, because when Jefferson wrote it, Jefferson had written, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." And Franklin changed that to, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." He said, "It's an assertion of reason, not of religion, of where we get our rights as a people." And that fit very much in with what Voltaire and Rousseau and the French philosophes were doing. And so he reprints all of these letters and the Declaration of Independence so he can appeal to the hearts and the minds of the French people.
Yeah, when Franklin changed the word sacred for self-evident, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." What did self-evident literally mean to him?
You know, he was a friend and a student of David Hume, who may have been the greatest of the British philosophers of the time. And there were certain truths that Hume said were not even based on evidence, which, like Philadelphia being larger or smaller than London, that's just based on evidence. But certain truths are there just by virtue of reason, almost by virtue of definition, like all bachelors are unmarried or all triangles have 180 degrees or something. And he said those are just intuitive, natural truths that you just have to look into the nature of the world to know that they're true. And that's what he meant about all people being created equal in terms of their political rights.
Did he get any argument from Jefferson about that change, do you know?
No, although there was a wonderful story, because Jefferson was very kind to Franklin. He just adored Franklin. And he wrote him these nice letters thanking him for the edits and saying, you know, he valued all the wisdom. So then they bring the document to Congress itself, and they're debating it on the floor of Congress. And, you know, Franklin had made these few small word changes, which Jefferson liked. Well, Congress started tearing the document apart, throwing out whole paragraphs, rewriting parts of it. And Jefferson got more and more depressed. And so Benjamin Franklin told him the tale of the first time that he had had a customer, and he wanted a sign that said, you know, John Smith makes and sells hats for ready cash on Market Street. And then all of his friends edited the sign, and at first they took out makes and sells. Well, you don't need that. You can just say he sells hats, and then you don't need to say ready cash. And by the end of it, everybody had taken out different parts of it, and it just said John Smith with a little hat next to it, is all the sign said. And Franklin said, that's why I always make it a habit never to be involved in writing documents that are going to be debated by a public body, because they're going to tear it apart. And Jefferson found it so amusing that he calmed down and didn't get upset at the way they were tearing apart his Declaration of Independence.
It's always interesting to see what each of the founding fathers believed about slavery and whether they owned slaves or not. What were Franklin's thoughts about slavery before the Revolution?
You know, when you deal with any of the founders, you have to wrestle with the institution of slavery. And Franklin himself wrestled with that institution. He owned a couple of slaves off and on, household slaves, throughout his life, and then he freed them. He printed some of the first anti-slavery tracts as a young newspaper man, but he also carried ads in his newspaper for the buying and selling of slaves. As his life went on, he became more and more anti-slavery, first against the slave trade and then for the freeing of all slaves. And it was the one sort of blot on a record spent fighting tyranny over all forms of oppression to man. And so at the end of his life, he takes on the job as the president of this abolition society, the Society for the Abolition of Slavery, and dedicates the last few years in his life to fighting slavery and to try to remove that blot from his record.
Early in his life, when he was skeptical of slavery, he wasn't an abolitionist at this point, but he thought it wasn't necessarily a good thing. He opposed it because he thought it wasn't healthy for the white owners, you know, that it would make the children lazy and shun work. What were his reasons when he became an abolitionist for opposing slavery?
You're right. He first starts off by saying, economically, it makes no sense. Then he says, it makes no sense even for the owners, because it makes us less industrious. And then finally, he says, it is just morally abhorrent to tyrannize another individual. And he was a believer in the end of slavery because of the very pure reason that all people are created equal and nobody should be denied rights by race, religion, or color. And that was a petition that he submitted to Congress near the end of his life. That's what he fought for. And then some Southern congressman from Georgia got up and made a speech on the floor of the House ridiculing him for saying that. And Franklin's last great parody that he writes, I mean, as a 16-year-old, he had written under the pen name of Silence Dugood. Now, in his 80s, on his deathbed, he writes another pseudonymous piece for the newspaper in which he parodies this congressman by pretending to have discovered the speech 100 years ago delivered by somebody in Africa who was defending the enslavement of white Christians and why it made sense to enslave white Christians. And it's an exact parody of the Southern congressman's speech. And there's Franklin on his deathbed trying to attack the institution of slavery with his pen.
Did Franklin have arguments with other founding fathers about slavery?
No, he was not an argumentative sort, and he probably should have had arguments on slavery, but during the Constitutional Convention, after a while, it became unspoken. People knew if they got into an argument about slavery, they would never end up with a constitution for a new country. They would split apart. And Franklin thought of raising the issue of slavery and forcing a debate and an argument on slavery, but instead he waits until after they finish the Constitution, and then he introduces it at the first Congress.
We haven't talked about Ben Franklin's scientific contributions. Why don't you just list some of the inventions and scientific contributions that he's responsible for?
He was the most important scientist of his time for one reason, which is he was the one who first figured out the nature of the flow of electricity. That electricity was a flow. He invented the terms positive and negative, or plus and minus, the term battery and condenser. And then he extended that to understand that lightning was a form of electrical discharge, and that you could sap the charges from a cloud through to a lightning rod. And up until then, lightning had been one of the most devastating scourges facing the earth. I mean, they used to ring church bells to try to ward off lightning, and in 1 year, 300 bell ringers got killed because of it. Franklin finally said, you know, we ought to try some different way of doing this, and he comes up with his lightning rod experiments. So that's the most important thing he does, is the lightning rod and discovering the nature of lightning. Also, there's hundreds of useful devices. He, like in his politics, he was very practical and pragmatic in his science. He invents the bifocals. He invents the Franklin stove, so you have clean-burning stoves. He invents fins so that you can swim with, and odometers, and many other things like that that make life a little bit easier.
What did the other founding fathers think of Ben Franklin? You know, because here he is, among other things, doing all this, like, tinkering and inventing and science, in addition to negotiating treaties and editing the Declaration of Independence. I mean, he has all these different lives.
Well, you know, I guess the most interesting relationship is the one with John Adams. And, you know, people say, well, Adams hated him and stuff. No, it's far more complicated. There was a grudging admiration and love-hate, especially on Adams's part, towards Franklin. And they begin their relationship once when they were off in 1775 or so, 1776 maybe, negotiating with Lord Howe on Staten Island to see Lord Howe had wanted the Americans to surrender during the Revolution. And so Franklin and Adams are sent to Staten Island to negotiate with them. Franklin's had this great theory about the contagious nature of colds, that you didn't catch cold by getting cold, you caught colds because germs, which he turned out to be right about. So they have to share a room on the way to Staten Island, and Franklin keeps opening the window in the middle of winter, and Adams keeps wanting it shut, and they have this big argument about it, and finally Adams concedes and lets Franklin explain his entire theory of the contagious nature of colds. And for years afterwards, both in Paris and in Philadelphia and other places, they were sort of rivals with each other, but friendly rivals who respected each other's patriotism. But Adams was very prudish and puritanical, and he thought that Franklin was, sort of repelled or appalled by Franklin's lascivious ways with the women of Paris. So that was the most amusing relationship.
So Franklin had lascivious ways with the women of Paris?
I think he would love to have had lascivious ways. I think by that point he was pushing 80, and so he had a lot of girlfriends in Paris, and he once played chess, and while Madame Briand, one of his girlfriends, soaked in the bathtub. But I, you know, maybe I'm a little too innocent or a little too naive. I think these were flirtations more of the mind and of the soul and of the heart than of the body.
Are you ever amused or even annoyed by the ways in which certain politicians and commentators invoke the names of the founding fathers for whatever political agenda they're pushing at the moment?
I am, which is why I wanted to write about one of the founders. I think that it's important to understand the founders in all of their complexity, not to look upon them as two-dimensional, not to look at them as pure paragons of virtue, but of really honest flesh and blood people who did some extraordinary things and actually were able to cobble together a nation that survived so well for three centuries. But you don't like the founding fathers to be invoked for every new idea that comes down the pike.
Walter Isaacson, he's the author of the new book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life.